Hi, I'm Rob Grease and I'm the producer of Australian Rock of Ages, and it's a pleasure to bring you another program in this series of 24 monthly programs that will feature the life and time stories of some of the people whose talent, skills and dedication have contributed to the development of Australian music, particularly through the 1960s and 1970s. In this program, we present the story of Normie Rowe. At what age did you start singing?
Those social nights, social evenings, there was invariably a piano player or a player piano, you know, a piano role player.
Yep.
And when I was 3, 4, 5 years old, I'd be singing along with all those things. First time on stage, I used to do this thing where I'd contort my throat, and as a little kid of 3 or 4 years old, sounded like Popeye. I'm Popeye the Sailor Man. I live in a car. It kind of hurts me now, but and every time at this. The social dancers, that get up and sing Popeye, Norman. Get up and sing Popeye, and I'll be up there. You know, you get the first round of applause, it's over.
That's a drug.
It's over. Yeah, that's the gone. End of it, right? Now it's just getting a song right. last 5 or 6 years I've been playing electric guitar in the show, which I never really bothered about. I started playing guitar when I was 8, 9 years old. I just love this thing.
Yeah.
I just love it. It just does stuff. And I love entertaining, and I love having fun with an audience. And, you know, I did 2 shows on the weekend, and it was just we all went away with an experience. I got probably more from the audience than certainly more than just getting paid money. I got more from doing that than perhaps they got from me being there. And
yes,
and it's gorgeous. So as a young kid, yeah. And then, you know, one of the other things I love doing is reading comics. And we used to swap comics, like kids swap footy cards and things like that these days. And I noticed on the back of comics that you could learn to play the guitar in 10 easy lessons.
Either that or kick sand in people's faces, one or the other, yeah.
And so I thought, oh, I'd love to be able to learn to play the guitar anyway. My brother bought a guitar and he was learning, but he just didn't have the diligence to sit down and, you know, you could hear him swearing in the background, huh? Bloody thing, trying to get his fingers around the chords. And when I think of the guitar he was trying to play, it's absolutely no wonder. Yeah. It's one thing kids have got today, access to
decent
very
instruments.
Cheap, decent instruments,
yeah,
you know.
That's right, yes.
You know, $200 or $300 and you've got a really good guitar you can learn to play.
Yeah.
But this was like, you know, it was like trying to get 8-year-old hands around a tree trunk.
Yeah.
You know, it was just going to be very hard. So Graham gave up and he said, would you like my guitar? And I said, oh, can I? And then I went off to the Victoria Banjo Club.
Mm-hmm.
I found the Victoria Banjo Club in the Herald or the Sun or something, you know. And I said, can I go to the Victoria Banjo Club? They teach guitar. So Mum found the money in the family budget, you know. Like I said, I don't think Mum and Dad ever, as long as they lived, ever lived much more than week to week.
Yes.
You know, Dad had 74 cents in his pocket on the Wednesday before he died. Thursday was payday.
Wow.
And he died at work. He was on the basic wage at the time, which was $74 a week.
Yeah.
And he was a foreman.
Wow.
You know, so you can understand.
Oh, yes.
And now, in hindsight, the sacrifices that Mum and Dad went through to make sure that the kids had some extra curricular activities, things like dance stuff for my sister. Obviously, Graham played footy and Lois played netball. Well, they still cost money and stuff like that. way more today. Just crazy how it costs kids, it costs parents for kids to play basic sports, you know, let alone my kids who wanted to play ice hockey. $2,500 just to set them up.
Couldn't choose a cheap activity, could they?
I said, wouldn't you like to, you know, learn to play tiddlywinks?
Table tennis?
Yeah. So, you know, these guitar lessons, you know, they cost
them.
It costs the family budget, of course. So there I'd be, not 10 years old. Here is the routine. Finish school, do whatever homework I had, which wasn't really that much in those days. Get cleaned up, because you could never get on the tram untidy.
No,
wouldn't be done. So I'd get dressed up, get my guitar case, and I'd wander down with my money in my pocket, pay the money for the tram ticket, and I'd go all the way into Swanson Street. I was 10, 8 or 9, 10.
Right? Safe to do so then, wasn't it though?
Yeah.
And big then, deal. A big deal.
And my lesson was, I think it was about 6:30, so I'd have the one-hour lesson with 40 other guitar-playing students, none of whom could actually play, including myself. Then I'd finish, and I'd go down. There was one of those sort of diner-type places in Swanson Street called The Crown, right? And it was the K-R-O-W-N, The Crown. And I guess it was run by some Greek lads, and I'd arrive, and they'd know that I was coming. And I'd have a milkshake or malted milk and a bucket of chips, and that'd be my dinner for the night. And then I go down and get the tram, and I get home, and it'd be dark, and Dad'd meet me at the tram and walk me across the road, because it was St. George's Road.
Yeah,
it was
busy.
And that was my weekly lesson. One day I forgot, and I was playing somewhere, just playing in the street somewhere, and I got home and Mum said, "Have you forgotten something?" And I went, "My guitar lesson." She said, "I'll let you off this time, but you do it again, there will be never any more guitar lessons." And that was a consequence that I knew she would keep, because parents kept consequences in those days.
Yes.
You know? The big problem today is people say, "If you don't do that, I'm going to kill you." And the kids know you're not going to kill
them. That's right. It's a Both our parents and society not only gave us guidelines, they gave us parameters, didn't they?
Yeah.
And, okay, we'd test them, but we knew they were there.
You know, I think the post-war baby boomers have given us the young society we've got today. I think we've been too slack.
The pendulum went too far. Oh, yeah. No doubt about that.
We've been too slack.
Yeah, yeah.
And then we allowed a whole lot of stuff to take. Like, I talk about the married man's wage. And the married man, for the same work that a single man was doing, would get more money.
Yes.
Because he was a married man and he had to look after his wife and family, right?
Yep.
That's out the door now. Everybody gets the same amount of money for the same job. And I can see, if you like, the fairness of it all. But society was inclusive in those days. Mm-hmm. You know, there were things that society was responsible for, but it was society, not the government. Years ago, it was the International Year of the Family, and it was during a Labor federal government tenure. And I was asked to be an ambassador for the... Right? Mm. So I'm at Melbourne Zoo and I made a speech. And I think the value of family is so important. I mean, it's a real, for me, it's the reason I'm still alive today. Really. And I really think that people have lost the reason for family quite often. And so I said, look, too long now, government has tried to take over the role of family and micro-society. In other words, the people around you, the community you live in. I said, you get out of work, we'll find you a job. you get sick, we'll make sure your health is taken care of. You want to get educated, we'll pay for your education. Now, about 5 minutes after I finished my speech, I lost my job as ambassador.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you know why? All of those things were Labor Party policies.
So you're speaking against the policy.
I can't work out how they... Either they do it on purpose to try and control people, or they just don't see it.
Well, I suspect that at the end of the day, to be honest, I don't think it matters whether it's right or left-wing governments. I think governments seem to have assumed now that they have the right to control everything about us.
Well...
Or we've abrogated it and give them that power.
That's what's happened. We've abrogated. Mm. We've abrogated. And, you know, I, on the way in today, I was listening to a radio program, and they were talking about tolls, toll roads. Mm-hmm. And I don't think anybody understands the history of toll roads. What happened with the, with roads in general were just a track between two towns, and they were dirt. And then along came cars, and they said, well, you know, if cars want better roads, then what we'll do is we will register cars, and the money we get from registration, we'll build roads. And the money they got from registration went into general revenue. Mm-hmm. And they said, well, the roads are not very good. We'll have to make the roads better. What we'll do is we'll generate a license to drive on the roads. Mm-hmm. And the money we get from the license, we'll build better roads. Mm-hmm. And the money they got from the license went into general revenue.
Funny about that.
Right? And yeah. It paid for everything else, all the other promises that they made, and the roads didn't get any better. And the planning became worse and worse. And then we weren't going to have any cars on the roads ever again because they pollute and they're bad and blah, blah, blah. And then all of a sudden they realise, oh, gee, we're going to have cars anyway no matter what. What we better do is we better have freeways, but they won't be freeways, they'll be tollways. They won't be free because the car drivers are going to get the benefit of these, right?
Mm.
Forget the fact that we're already paying for the roads. Mm. We're going to have the tolls, and the tolls will pay for the roads. And so... constantly we're going, yeah, that's all right, that's all right. Along comes Bob Carr, and he's in New South Wales, and he says, that road between Melbourne and Sydney, that Hume Highway, we've got to do something about that. People are dying. We're going to build this. So what we're going to do is we're going to put 3 cents a litre on the petrol for 3 years, and then we'll take it off. And after 3 years, they said, the road's not finished, we're going to make it for another 2 years, and we're going to put it up to five. So we're going to have 5 cents a litre for 5 years.
Guess what?
Right. And now it's 5 cents a litre forever.
That's right. Right.
Along comes the pyramid thing in Victoria, you know, that pyramid financial meltdown thing that was going on. And Jeff Kennett says, how can we fix this? I know, but Bob Carr foisted onto the people of New South Wales this wonderful thing of state petrol tax, we'll do that. Mm. So he put on 3 cents a litre for 3 years, but it's now, you know, course.
Yeah.
But this is the best one that politicians have done ever. I was living in Queensland at the time, and Peter Beattie was the Premier, and he came up with this concept that the Queensland people were subsidising the Queensland drivers because Queensland didn't have that tax.
Oh.
So we better put that tax on. And the people copped it. And I just said, oh, my God, this is the perfect example of you only get the government you deserve. If you're not prepared to stand up and say so, it's just crazy. Politicians and bureaucrats drive me insane.
Yeah. I can see that. Let's draw it back to you career.
It's all about me, of course, this program.
It is all about you. And when did you first get on stage professionally and earn some money from it?
The first show I ever did was with Mel Clark, one of my schoolmates from high school, first year in high school. And we got paid, I think it was about 10 and 6 between us to play a Jewish kids' dance in at the Maccabean Hall, I think it's called, up in Mansfield Street, Thornbury. And we only had about four songs, and we had two guitars and a microphone plugged into a little 5-watt amplifier. I don't know what people were hearing, but and we had one of the songs was "When the Saints Go Marching In," and we did that three or four times in the night because
yeah.
I mean it didn't really fit a Jewish dance.
No, it didn't. What?
And then we're going. And when the tram driver came marching in, and when the tram driver comes marching, oh, I want to be in the number when the tram driver. And we're trying to think of, and when the high school master goes, and we're trying desperately to spread it out. Oh, dear. And by this time, you know, I was only 12, and it was, you know, that's we're having a bit of fun doing
yeah,
this.
Yeah, yeah.
And Mal and I were going to the Lutapano Music School by this time down at St Kilda Junction. And some of the other people, John Farrar from The Strangers, mm-hmm. is in a photo, that end of year photo with us. And it was fantastic. Some of Melbourne's great players came out of that school, you know. Anyway, then we met up with a couple of other kids. Rock and roll music, pop music at high school, at our high school, was frowned upon.
Mm-hmm.
Was really frowned upon. If you were a kid who was doing the Estedfords and learning, you know, proper singing.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
They were, those sort of things were encouraged.
Mm-hmm.
Our music teacher, whose name was Joseph King, and we used to say, "You must be joking." And
our kids are good at doing that.
Oh, dear.
Yeah.
Anyway, you know, we were learning music appreciation, and music appreciation was about when Beethoven was born and died and what he, you know, his fifth and where
stuff you might have appreciated when you're a lot older, but not at that age.
No. No, I don't think you're completely right there, because if it's taught the right way, if you make it accessible by using, you know, for instance, the Fifth Dimension had at the time of their Up, Up and Away album, written and produced by Jimmy Webb, they did The Rhythm of Life,
mm-hmm.
right? And I think somebody else did. I think the Temptations and the Supremes did it together. Right, and then and it was and the rhythm of light is a
oh, yeah, appreciate that. But we are talking 1959, though, aren't we? Here, not
yeah.
later on.
Yeah, true.
And at this stage, you know, we've
but if you did, if they did teach it that way,
if they had taken some of the
early rock and roll things, and
yeah.
if you look at people like Louis Jordan and even
yep.
Cab Calloway
yep.
in the '20s, I'm going to tell you this. I was driving to Ipswich one day to do a show, and I was listening to Bay FM, which is a community radio station upon which this may very well be heard. And they were playing old blues, and Ella Fitzgerald was singing a song they played, and she sang, "Rock me, roll me, rock and roll me all night long,"
mm-hmm.
right? And then I said, wow. I wonder how old this is. And the announcer came back and said, that was Ella Fitzgerald from the 1934. Mm. So rock and roll had been around.
Well, the term certainly had.
The term, that's
the
what
term
I'm saying, the term.
Had, yes.
But, you know, even the if you listen to early 1950s, late 1940s, when I was born, you listen to some of the music being played, the hot music
yeah,
coming
absolutely.
Out of the jazz joints of
jazz joints, western swing, yeah, but that's the whole thing about rock and roll, isn't it? It's a melting pot. It came out
yeah,
of stylistically.
Yeah. There's no such thing really as rock and roll. It's just it's an umbrella term
yeah.
for all sorts of
yeah.
all sorts of genres. You know, I believed that rock and roll really was the stuff that Bill Haley and the Comets recorded.
Mm.
Well.
Well,
yeah. But they got it from somewhere.
I was going to say.
And theirs was, nowadays they call that, what do they call that? Rockabilly, you know. But you listen to some of the guitar playing in those things, in 13 Women and Rock Around the Clock. That's just straight modern jazz guitar playing, you know, just beautiful technique and, you know.
So, okay, we've got this crossover period from the 50s into the 60s.
Yeah.
And we've certainly now got Bill Haley, and we've got television.
Look, let me just let's take us back a second. I wanted to do something with this guitar, and I was learning hillbilly stuff because that's what was there, you know. And then, of course, Rock Around the Clock happened, and all those sort of things. But the movie that started everything for rock and roll in Australia, the movie that started, was Blackboard Jungle.
Right? Oh, that was,
and that was almost a no-no for good kids from good families to go and see.
Parents and authorities, didn't it? That movie. Oh yeah.
And then, of course, I think it was Rock, 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 and I saw that at the Merry Picture Theatre, and they had a band on, whom I may be wrong, included Bobby Cookson, thinking that it was Bobby Cookson. Well, and Melbourne had rock and roll going then, you know, Johnny Chester, and certainly Sydney had with O'Keefe and his cohorts running the Paddington Town Hall, or Paddington Town Hall, or RSL, and of course, the Jacobson brothers, Coljoy and Kevin, they had their dances running, and they were entrepreneurial in what they were doing, because I guess they had to be. Nobody else wanted rock and roll in their dances because it was, you know, would undermine the genteel nature of the modern, you know, ballroom dancing.
That's right. Speaking for myself, one of the big moments in the early 60s was that tsunami of music that came out of Britain.
Yeah.
That just rolled over what we saw as rock and roll. Did that have an impact on you?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I'd been singing by this stage in rock dances since my first band with Mel Clark and Marty Christian, Marty Van Eggs. We had a band playing rock and roll songs in the Elphington Methodist Church Hall. And then I was playing Bruce Stewart's Sunday afternoon festival hall shows. And I was doing that with a band Johnny Cooper was fronting up. And I went on stage one day, and I didn't wash my hair, and I didn't use hair oil, and I didn't have a rocker's haircut because I'd seen what the Beatles were doing, and a girl started screaming. And I came off stage and said, yeah, bull. So the next week I came on with my rocker haircut again, and they said, put your hair down like the Beatles, put your hair down. So I grabbed and pulled it all down. It looks stupid probably. But that was the last time I ever did a rock and roll haircut. I had my first publicity shot was taken by Wilbur Williams Studios up in High Street opposite the Northcote Town Hall. And, you know, the very first time I ever recorded was Mal and I at the Wilbur Williams Studio. He had a cutting lathe. And we played straight to an acetate.
Oh, wow, okay.
How about that?
Yeah, okay.
That was really advanced nature.
Yes.
So we recorded that Buddy Holly song. What was it called? There you go, baby, here in my well. You left me here so I could sit and cry. Well, whoops-a-daisy, how you drive me crazy. Well, I guess it doesn't matter anymore. You know, so we recorded that. It probably doesn't exist anymore, but sadly, boy, I would love to have that.
Of course you would.
That, not for me. I would give it immediately to the National.
Oh, I was going to say, because it would be a treasure. It would be so,
Yeah, I'd give it straight to that, because I think it's probably deserving of that.
This program is a Handsome Doc production and is podcast through the Toorak Times and TAG.